Claire said. Just more mountains. Well, Richard said, let's find out. And the trio began walking uphill. It had been almost a day since they had left the small town on the Adriatic in the plane flown by Gabriel's friend, hopscotching their way across the Mediterranean, landing on splinters and shards of the magical world, first in Greece, then Cyprus, and lastly in Lebanon, refueling each time before flying out over the endless desert of the Arabian Peninsula. The pilot had landed at the base of the mountains on the southern coast, next to a village of mud and concrete houses. It was there that they'd found the boy with the truck. Gabriel's shoulder was stiff from the blow he'd received the night before, and he adjusted the strap of his pack, which carried food and water for him and the couple. The man and woman were still weak, but they were tough and kept on uncomplaining. Gabriel gauged that they had 3 hours till nightfall, and then the temperature would drop quickly. "It is time," Gabriel said, keeping a steady, tireless stride, pausing only now and then so he did not overtake the couple, "for you to tell me what we are doing here and how you hope to uncover the rest of the prophecy." He had not pressed them during the previous legs of their journey, the noise of the aeroplane and the rattling of the truck having rendered conversation impossible, and, during their brief breaks, the couple had needed all the rest they could get. "Of course," Richard said, breathing hard. "Tell me, though, how much do you know about the prophecy and the prophet? What did Pym tell you?" Gabriel confessed that, in truth, he knew very little about the ancient prophecy that had so ruled his and the children's lives. Only its essence, that the children would find the books, unite them, and then perish. "That's not surprising," Richard said. "Most people, if they know about the prophecy at all, don't know more than that." But the couple explained how, years before, when Dr. Pym had told them who their children were destined to be, they had devoted themselves to learning everything they could about the books and their history, and this had included the prophecy. "We didn't learn everything, obviously," Richard said. "We only found out about the predictions of the children's deaths when Rourke told us a few months ago. But we still know quite a bit," Claire said. "Right. So more than 1,000 years ago, there was a famous seer among one of the nomadic tribes of the Sahara. He made hundreds of predictions about wars, famines, plagues, disasters, both natural and magical. And they weren't your usual vague, mumbly sorts of prophecies that could be yanked to fit almost any situation. They were specific, like, everyone in this particular village should get out by this date because there's going to be a plague of killer bees." "And he was right," Claire said, "again and again." "And the last prediction he made," Richard said, "was about the children and the books. Then he vanished."
"You mean he died?"
"No, vanished. Along with his whole tribe, just disappeared out of the desert. There are plenty of mentions in contemporary accounts. He was famous after all. People noticed he was gone. Maybe he got tired of people always hunting him down and asking him to predict the future, or maybe he was in some kind of danger, so he disappeared and took his people with him. No one knows." "Only the tribe didn't really vanish," Claire said. "It wasn't long before reports began popping up of people seeing the tribe in the South American jungle. In Papua New Guinea, on the Russian steppes, the Faroe Islands."
"And this is one of the places," Gabriel said, "these mountains?"
"Yes," Richard said. "We found an account in the memoirs of a 14th century spice trader who stumbled onto the tribe. That village where we left the plane, that was an old trading post. The trader went east from there into the mountains, same as we are, and that's where he found them."
"And are you simply hoping this tribe is still here?"
Gabriel said, suddenly afraid he had been mistaken in trusting the couple's judgment.
No, no, of course not, Claire said. We studied this. We went through all the accounts we could find, plotting out the places they'd been seen, and eventually a pattern emerged. It turned out the tribe was still nomadic. Only instead of migrating hundreds of miles, they migrated thousands all across the globe, and they went to certain places at certain times, rotating on a 50-year cycle. It was very clear once you saw it. We never had a chance to tell Pym, because we only discovered all this just before we were captured. But they should be here now. If our theory is right, Richard said quietly. Which Gabriel thought was a rather large if. But he did not voice his doubt, nor did he question how, even if they did find this lost tribe, they expected that to lead to the revelation of the rest of the prophecy. Did they think the prophecy would be written down in the village library? That the prophet's old tribe would remember it verbatim? He didn't ask because he already knew the answer. The couple didn't know. They were here because they had nowhere else to go, and slim as this hope might be, it was their only one. I don't understand, Claire said. This isn't right. They had followed the path up around the side of the mountain till they reached a cliff and were now staring out at more desolate red-brown peaks in the distance. The path wound down the face of the mountain away from them. In the spice trader's account, Claire said, he followed the eastern road from the village, the same as we did, but he said there was a bridge to another mountain and he followed it to the village. Where's the bridge? Where's the village? Her voice was tight with panic and frustration. Maybe we missed a turn, Richard said, or we're on the wrong road. But there are no other eastern roads. It's just like the boy said. There's nothing up here. As the couple debated, Gabriel glanced back at the path they had come up.
The trader's account. It is very old.
From the 14th century. Claire said, but it was incredibly detailed. Even if the bridge had fallen, there should be some evidence.
So it was written before the separation, Gabriel went on, before the magical world pulled away. What was clear then would now be hidden.
Without waiting for the couple to respond, he walked back along the path. 60 yards from the cliff, he found what he was looking for. A watery glimmer in the air. In the dying light, he had walked right past it. He heard Richard and Claire behind him.
Focus on the shimmer, Gabriel said as he stepped into it, feeling the tingle and the world widening around him. And then he was through, and the air still tasted the same. The sun hung at the same place in the sky. Everything was the same, but also different, for he was now in the magical world.
He heard Claire gasp and Richard say, "Whoa!" They were looking, he knew, at the mountain not 100 yards away, the mountain that had not been there moments before and was connected to the peak on which they stood by a long rope or hemp bridge that hung suspended over a 1,000-foot drop.
"This is the bridge in the trader's account," Richard exclaimed.
"The village should be just on the other side." He started forward, but Gabriel put out a hand to hold him back.
"What are you doing? We have to hurry. We are not alone," Gabriel said.
4 or 5 large boulders studding the top of the mountain stood between themselves and the bridge, and the couple was silent now, for they could see the shadows disengaging themselves from the boulders and becoming men cloaked in the same shades and hues as the rocks, holding short, curved bows, and with long daggers stuck in their belts.
"They were here the whole time, weren't they?" Richard whispered. "In the magic world, waiting to see if we would come through."
"Yes."
"Let me talk to them," Claire said. "I'll tell them we're not here to hurt them."
"I doubt they're worried about that," Richard said. One man, tall and lean with a thick black beard and skin the color of the rocks, stepped forward.
He looked at Gabriel, then held out his hand. Gabriel hesitated, then unslung his sword and passed it over, giving the man his knife and pack as well. Jamming Gabriel's knife in his belt and slipping the pack and sword over his shoulder, the man turned and motioned for them to follow. They fell into a line, Gabriel, Claire, and finally Richard, with the band of men behind, and they made their way to the bridge and then across, the bridge swinging beneath their feet. The next peak was narrower than the one they had left, and the tall man led them through a passage in the rock, a short tunnel that Gabriel hadn't seen from the other side, and a minute later they stepped out, and the village lay before them, 30 red-brown houses of compacted mud terraced into the concave face of the mountain. Gabriel could see figures moving about and hear the bleating of goats and the dull clanking of bells. As they came into the village, women and children came out to watch them pass, all of them dressed in the same long cloaks as the men, and they stared at Gabriel and the couple with large, dark eyes. Gabriel looked up the narrow path between the mud and stone huts, and he saw a figure move aside a rug that hung over the doorway of the last hut and step into the path. It was an old man, stooped and bald, and Gabriel was not surprised when the bearded leader of the band stopped before him. The old man looked more like a tortoise than anyone Gabriel had ever seen, with his skin both wrinkled and yet strangely smooth. He was leaning on a crooked cane, and he peered closely at Gabriel and at the couple.
"Tell him who we are," Richard said.
Claire said something, and the old man nodded, murmuring a reply.
"He says," Claire's voice was quiet, "that he's been expecting us."
The old man pulled back the blanket and gestured into the darkness of his house. Richard and Claire exchanged a glance and stepped through. Gabriel moved to follow, but the bearded man barred his way. Then the old man stepped into the house, dropping the blanket behind him. The old man led Richard and Claire to the back room and gestured to them to sit on the floor, which was covered with overlapping rugs. He sat facing them on the other side of a small oil stove, which he quickly and deftly lit, and began heating up a pot of water. The old man had a weathered and leathery skull, heavy-lidded dark eyes, and as he manipulated the stove, his fingers stayed locked together, giving his hands the appearance of flippers. He was adding various things to the pot, herbs, roots, powders, and stirring them with a stick from the floor.
"Ask him," Richard said, "what he meant when he said he was waiting for us."
Claire spoke, then listened to the old man's response, and said to her husband,
"He says that we must be the parents of the keepers, that it was foretold we would come." "Who is he?" Richard asked. "Is he the prophet?"
Claire translated, and the old man made a dismissive noise before responding.
"He says the prophet has been dead for 1,000 years. He is merely the one who sits in his place."
"Look," Richard leaned forward, "not to be rude, it's just that time is kind of an issue. The reason we're here..." But the old man was already speaking. Claire listened, then translated.
"He asks if we wish to hear the prophecy concerning the children and the books. Is that not the reason we have come?"
Claire responded herself. The old man shook his head, and Claire said,
"He says he doesn't know the prophecy."
"But," Richard began.
"He says," Claire went on, "that we must hear it from the prophet."
"But the prophet's dead," Richard nearly shouted.
"He just said so."
The pot on the stove was now bubbling, and the old man went to a small wooden box against the wall, undid the latch, and opened it. He took out an object bound in cloth, carefully unwrapping it to reveal a cloudy, whitish crystal in roughly the shape of a cube. He began to speak quickly, and Claire asked several questions, nodding if she understood or frowning if she didn't.
"What is that?" Richard asked. "He says it is a moment of frozen time."
The old man dropped the cube into the boiling pot and began to stir.
He says, Claire was translating as the man spoke, that if we wish to hear the prophecy, we must hear it from the prophet. We must go back in time.
But only the Atlas can take you through time, Richard said. Pym told us.
He says the cube was a piece of that time long ago. We will take it inside ourselves. It will be a part of us. We'll see and hear as if we were there.
Then the old man took two slender glasses and poured in the dark, steaming, oddly thick liquid. He held them out in shaking hands.
I'll do it, Richard said to his wife. Only one of us has to.
The old man seemed to understand, for he clucked his tongue.
He says we both have to, Claire said. That is what was foretold, and that is what has been prepared, both or neither, that we came here seeking the answer, and this is the answer. Will we take it?
It was dark now, and the temperature was dropping rapidly. Gabriel stood staring at the hut and the man who guarded the doorway. It seemed to Gabriel that he could feel each second ticking by. He had no idea what was happening on Loris or to Emma in the world of the dead, but if the couple did not emerge soon, he would force his way in. Then Gabriel noticed an odd thing. Villagers, men, women, and children were moving up the path toward the top of the mountain. They moved in ones and twos, sometimes whole families. They were going into what looked like a temple of some kind that had been carved into the stone at the mountain's peak, some 50 or so feet above the rest of the village. They were all carrying bundles. Two young boys herded a dozen bleating goats up the path, disappearing as well into the mouth of the temple. In less time than Gabriel would have guessed possible, the village was empty and silent. It was just him and the tall guard. Then the blanket over the door moved, and the old man emerged. He looked at Gabriel and said, in English,
"You must protect them till they return. All depends on that."
Then the bearded man took the old man's arm, and they headed up the path. Gabriel's pack, knife, and sword had been left on the ground. Gabriel immediately stepped into the small house, ducking his head for the low ceiling. He found the couple in the back room, stretched out on the floor, a pair of empty glasses on the ground beside them. Both were breathing, but their pulses were faint. He sniffed at one of the glasses, but couldn't identify the smell. He hurried out to see the old man and his companion entering the temple above.
"Wait!"
Gabriel raced up the hill. As he got close, he saw that the temple was just a columned facade that had been carved into the rock, giving way to a shallow cave. He stepped into the darkness. The cave was only 10 feet deep. He was alone. There was no sign of the villagers, the goats, the old man. They had moved on. Gabriel stepped out into the chill night air, and as he did, a distant flickering caught his eye. From the steps of the temple, he could see past the rope bridge and across to the mountain they had climbed that afternoon. A line of torches far down the mountain was climbing slowly upward. He could not make out the figures, but on some deep, instinctual level, he knew who they were. And he understood the old man's final words. Their enemy had found them. Chapter 19. The Prophecy Revealed. Peering over the side of the mountain, Gabriel saw what he was searching for, a small cave, 30 feet down the face, and he went back to the house and carried first the woman, then the man, up to the edge of the cliff. He tied a rope around each in turn and lowered them down. Then he fixed his rope to a large boulder and climbed down himself. The cave was just deep enough that Richard and Claire would be invisible from above. The question was, if he himself were killed, would they be able to climb up without a rope? but to leave a rope in place would negate the whole point of their being hidden. He debated the point for a few seconds, then climbed up the cliff and took the rope from the boulder. He would have to make sure he survived. Before hiding the children's parents, Gabriel had first assured himself that the grass bridge was the only way on or off the mountaintop, and indeed there were nothing but steep cliffs on all sides. The simplest thing would be to cut the bridge, but that would only strand him and the couple while doing nothing about the enemy, who would, sooner or later, find another way across. In the end, he sawed through half of the grass cables that held the bridge in place, then hurried over to the other peak and along the path to take up a position that gave him a vantage point on the trail below. He counted 28 torches and thought he could see more figures that were not holding torches, perhaps 40 in all. Gabriel had found a bow left behind in the village, as well as a dozen arrows, and he now identified two places higher up the path where he could retreat and continue firing. He settled in to wait, and as he did, he found himself remembering how, over the past decade, he had made yearly visits to whatever orphanage had then housed the children. The first time had been 5 years after the adventure in Cambridge Falls, and the orphanage was a grand old building on the banks of the Charles River in Boston. From across the street, he'd seen Emma, still an infant, being rocked in her sister's arms. By the second year, Emma had been staggering around with the drunken, fat-legged gait of a toddler. And so it had gone, year after year, orphanage after orphanage. He never stayed long. He was never seen. Over the course of a decade, those 10 visits had added up to what? An hour? But however brief, they had given him strength for whatever missions and trials awaited him in the year ahead. Richard and Claire had never had that. They had not seen their children once during all their years of captivity, and yet they were still willing to go to any length, to take any risk, to ensure their safety. The old man's admonition to protect the couple had been unnecessary. Gabriel would protect them just as he would have their children. He heard a shout from below and a curse, and he looked and saw, in the midst of the group, a bald head rising above the rest, reflecting the glare of the torches. He notched an arrow on his string and got ready. Claire opened her eyes and was blinded. As she blinked, letting her eyes adjust, she heard what sounded like the flapping of a tent in the wind. She sensed Richard beside her. When she could finally see, she caught her breath. She and Richard were on the rug-covered floor of an open-air tent, encamped beside a small oasis in a sea of endless white dunes. More tents dotted the sand. Cloaked figures moved about.
"Richard, it's like he said."
Her husband's voice was quiet with awe.
"We've gone back in time. We're in the Sahara, back when the tribe were desert nomads. But I don't think we're really here. I think this might be a memory."
He cut himself off. A few feet away, a man was sitting with his eyes closed. He had white hair and a white beard, and a face made up almost entirely of wrinkles. He was so quiet and still that he seemed a part of the landscape.
"You think he can hear us?" Richard said.
"No, it's like we're ghosts."
Claire knelt before him.
"I wonder if he's..."
The old man's eyes snapped open, and Claire fell backward in alarm.
"Claire, I'm fine, but look."
The old man's eyes were all pupil, but then slowly they changed, the pupils shrinking, the whites appearing. Claire now turned to follow the old man's gaze. A tall figure in a dark cloak and hood was approaching the tent. Claire and Richard both moved back and waited. The hooded figure entered and sat down before the old man.
"You've come,"
the old man said. It was only later that the couple would wonder how it was that although the two men had not been speaking English or any language Richard and Claire recognized,
They had understood every word. The hooded figure said,
"You know why I am here?"
"Yes, but you must see it."
"I wish to know about the books. Who will find them? When will they be found?"
"I must see your face."
The visitor pushed back his hood. He was a man in middle age with close-cropped dark hair and severe features. But Claire found herself staring at his eyes, which were the most startling emerald green she had ever seen. With his 12 arrows, Gabriel managed to down 11 imps and screechers. His first arrow had been for the bald giant, but somehow, could his hearing be so sharp, Rourke had dodged out of the way. Gabriel didn't waste any more time on Rourke, but with a new arrow on his string every second, he drew and released, while on the slope below, Rourke cursed and struck at the imps and Moram Cadi and struggled to maintain order. After firing his last arrow, Gabriel didn't wait to see what would happen next. The trail his attackers were on skirted the edge of the cliff till it reached the bridge, and for nearly 60 yards was no more than 2 feet wide, with a plunge of 1,000 feet on one side and a steep rocky slope on the other. Gabriel planted himself in the middle of the trail, drew his sword, and waited. A screecher was the first to appear. Gabriel saw its yellow eyes glowing in the darkness, and the creature ripped forth one of its awful cries and charged. Gabriel had chosen a spot where the ground gave way, a fact he hid with his body. He stood utterly still, and when the Moram Cadi was a yard or so from him, he leapt backward, and the screecher, rushing forward, lost its footing and, with a kick from Gabriel, tumbled off the cliff. His next attacker was hard on the heels of the first, the next right behind him, with yet another following. Gabriel fought with every ounce of skill and strength and cunning he had, blocking, striking, thrusting, kicking, punching, shoving, cutting down some of his attackers while doing his best to hurl others off the cliff. And all the while, he was being pushed backward, step by step. Several times his enemies tried to rush him, but they got jammed up on the path, with one invariably grabbing at another and sending both into the void. By the time he'd reached the grass bridge, he'd cut their numbers by another 13. Then a crossbow bolt whizzed out of the darkness and buried itself in his left shoulder, the same shoulder that had been wounded by the imp the night before. The impact jerked him back, and a moment later, pain exploded across his chest and neck. He yanked the bolt out and jammed it into the eye of an imp that was rushing forward. Then, seeing Rourke's bald head round the edge of the path and feeling the throb of the poison in his shoulder, he turned and ran. When he reached the far side of the bridge, he looked and saw only 6, 4 screeches and 2 imps rushing across. Rourke had held the others back. An imp was nearly to him when Gabriel cut the bridge. The creatures tumbled into space, a few clinging to the bridge till it whiplashed down and struck the side of the mountain. He heard Rourke's laughter from across the chasm.
"Well played, lad, though it seems to me you've treed yourself. How are you expecting to shimmy down from there? Never you fret, we'll be over soon enough."
But Gabriel had already turned away to begin planning the next stage of the fight.
"That cannot be."
The old seer opened his hands.
"It is as it will be. 3 children will come. They will find the books. They are the keepers."
"And then what?"
the green-eyed man sneered.
"Speak. What happens when they find the books?"
The old man closed his eyes again, shaking his head.
"The path from there is not yet determined. If the keepers bring the books together and no more, then they and the books will be destroyed."
"But there is another path,"
the man said, leaning forward.
"Away, the books will not be destroyed. The power cannot be lost. What is the other way?"
After a moment, the old man nodded.
I see two paths. In one, the keepers bring the books together, and they and the books are destroyed. In the other, the three become one.
What do you mean, three become one?
Three books into one book, three keepers into one keeper. If this happens, the final bonding will occur.
The green-eyed man was silent, his head bowed. Then he looked up and smiled.
Another keeper? That is what you are saying? A final keeper for the final bonding? One who can control the power of the books?
He reached into his cloak.
Thank you, old man.
Claire saw the knife and screamed, but only Richard heard her. They used crossbow bolts, the ends of which were tied with light, strong ropes, and they fired them across the chasm so that the bolts buried themselves in the dirt and rock on the other side. Gabriel tried to leap out and cut the ropes, but Rourke was ready, and more bolts and arrows drove him back. At that point, there was nothing he could do but wait. Finally, when there were more than a dozen of the narrow ropes suspended across the chasm, one of the Moramkadi took hold of the bundle of cables and scuttled across upside down. Once on Gabriel's side, the creature secured the ropes around one of the posts that had held the bridge. At that point, only Rourke and five others, three screeches and two imps, remained. But Gabriel's left arm was nearly useless, and he could feel the poison spreading through his body. He knew that if he didn't treat the wound properly and soon, the poison would find his heart. Gabriel got lucky when one of the screeches simply fell off the improvised rope bridge. That left four. Rourke himself started across last of all, the posts on either side bowing under his weight. There was still one imp on the ropes, but two screeches and another imp were already on his side, and Gabriel rushed down upon them, howling. The ground where they fought was rocky and sloped, and Gabriel cut down all three, but the last imp, leaping off the ropes, slashed him viciously down his back before Gabriel kicked him in the chest and sent him over the cliff. Gabriel was gasping with pain and using his sword as a cane to steady himself.
Ah, no, lad, I do hate to see you in this sad state.
Gabriel turned to see Rourke stepping over the smoking body of one of the screeches as he pulled out his long twin knives.
But you must have always known it would come to this.
Gabriel looked at him for a long moment, then straightened, ignoring the pain in his shoulder and back, and said,
Are we going to talk or fight?
Claire!
She had fallen to her knees beside the old prophet, who was bleeding out on the rugs.
That can't be all, she cried. There has to be something else, some way to save them.
Figures had come running when the seer had cried out, but the green-eyed man had already vanished. Three men had laid the old man down, and one was pressing a bundled scarf onto his wound. The old man grabbed at the man, and Richard heard the prophet ordering the man to take their people away, warning that the green-eyed sorcerer would return. They had to run and keep running. Then the old seer reached out and grabbed a handful of sand, brought it to his lips, and seemed to breathe into it, whispering. He held out his hand.
They will come, the parents of the keepers. One day they will come. Give them this. Keep it safe.
He opened his hand, and Richard saw the milky white cube fall into the hand of the other man. The scene before him began to dim.
Claire!
But she was leaning toward the dying prophet, sobbing.
Tell me how to save the children.
Then the old man said, his voice failing,
He did not let me speak the end.
Tell us. We're here. Tell us.
After the final bonding.
The man's voice dropped below a whisper, and Richard saw his wife place her ear next to the man's lips, straining to catch the words, her tears falling unfelt upon the old man's face. Then Claire wrenched back, shouting, "No!" And the world vanished before them.
"This is so disappointing!"
They were battling along the edge of the cliff. Gabriel was fighting one-handed, and, whether out of sportsmanship or to show his contempt, Rourke was doing the same. Gabriel had attacked with all his remaining strength, but it did no good. He remembered their fight in the fortress, and, before that, in the volcano in Antarctica. Somehow the giant Irishman was stronger and faster than ever, as he blocked or dodged every one of Gabriel's blows with ease. Gabriel swung his sword in an arc, but Rourke ducked and punched him in his wounded shoulder with the butt of his knife, causing Gabriel to cry out.
"Come now, lad, I scarcely touched you. Don't be going soft on me."
Gabriel lunged again, and Rourke again slipped inside and this time thudded an elbow into Gabriel's face. Gabriel went blind for a moment and stumbled backward over the rocks. He knew that the edge of the cliff was near, but he caught himself in time, even as he felt the emptiness only feet away. Rourke was walking slowly forward.
"So, where are the kiddies' parents? I don't imagine they'll be too hard to flush out. There can't be too many places to hide around here."
Gabriel attacked again, and this time, when Rourke slipped inside his intentionally clumsy attack, Gabriel was ready and ran his shoulder into the man's stomach. Rourke let out a grunt and grabbed Gabriel by the hair and smashed his head against a boulder before tossing him away as one might a cat.
"You know, all this is pointless. Yes, the children are doomed. It's fate, stronger than any of us."
Gabriel glanced toward the edge of the cliff. He needed to lure the man closer. Rourke fainted again, and then struck with his knife. Gabriel felt the tip slide across his chest and stomach. He staggered back, his hand going to his sliced-open stomach, as if to hold himself together. But he saw that he was finally at the lip of the cliff. He raised his sword feebly, but Rourke struck it away, and the sword went spinning out of his hand into the void. Rourke thrust again, and Gabriel twisted so that the blade only went through his side instead of killing him. He dropped to his knees. Rourke was above him.
"Your whole life, lad, and it's all been for naught. Just a grand waste."
Gabriel felt himself seized by the neck and lifted so that his feet came off the ground. He was staring into the black pits of Rourke's eyes. Was he right? If Gabriel died now, if the children died, had it all been for nothing?
"Time's up, lad."
Rourke drew back his knife.
"You are wrong,"
Gabriel said, his voice choking under the man's grip.
"What's that?"
Rourke asked, pausing.
"You say something."
Gabriel knew there was no way he could make the man understand, even though in that moment it was so clear to him that to love someone and to live your life guided by that love could never be a waste. Indeed, it was the only life there was.
"Are you smiling? Have you gone daft on me, lad?"
Gabriel repeated.
"You are wrong."
Rourke snarled, and his knife drew back again. Then Gabriel thought of his sword, of Granny Pete's gift, and it was not at the bottom of the cliff, but in his hand, warm and solid, and with one thrust he drove the blade through the giant man's chest. It seemed to take Rourke a moment to understand what had happened. Then, almost carefully, he set Gabriel back down on the ground. The stunned expression never left his face, and Gabriel watched the man's eyes as the light went out of them.
"Well, now," Rourke said.
He pitched forward and lay still. With difficulty, Gabriel turned him over, then drew his sword from the man's chest and used it to walk to the top of the hill. He passed out once on the way, but he got to the place where he'd hidden the rope, secured it again to the boulder, then threw the coil over the cliff so that the rope dangled over the mouth of the cave. He called down,
"It is I!"
A moment later, the silhouette of Richard's head appeared in the darkness below.
"Thank goodness!"
The man's voice sounded very small in the empty air.
"We didn't want to shout. We only just came to. What happened?"
"Rourke found us."
"Rourke?"
"He is dead. Did you learn the rest of the prophecy?"
"Yes. I mean, I think so. Claire heard it. She hasn't been able to tell me yet."
And Gabriel heard the sound of sobs coming from deeper inside the cave.
"Listen," Richard said. "We'd better come up, then we can talk about it."
Gabriel sat down at the edge of the cliff to wait. There were bandages and herbs in his pack, but he had no energy or strength to go and get them. He would wait for the couple. He found himself thinking about Emma. For 15 years he had traveled the world, and she had been with him every step of the way, just as she was with him now. He saw the rope go taut, and he heard the scrape of the couple's feet on rock as they began to ascend. Then he looked up at the stars and thought that his heart had never felt so full. Chapter 20. The Prison. Emma tried to keep up, but her legs being by far the shortest, she invariably fell behind. Then there'd be a hard yank on the cord binding her wrists, curses, perhaps a kick, and she'd be dragged forward. She tried whispering to her fellow captives, 3 men and a woman, to find out where they were being taken, but they only stared at her with the blank expressions of the dead and said nothing. She told herself she just had to get free, get the book, find the portal back to the world of the living, and then it would all be okay. That was it. She could do it. But even if she did all that, which she knew was a pretty big if, the thought of touching the book, of letting all those voices back into her head, filled her with a terrible throat-clenching panic. And the book had spoken to her. "Release them," it had said. Release who? Did it mean the voices? She'd be happy to, but how? And release them where? She sucked on her lip, swollen where the man had hit her, and for the 100th time she wished that Gabriel was there. She'd like to see what he'd do to that guy who'd hit her. He'd kill him, that's what he'd do. Or kill him again, since technically the guy was already dead. But if he and the fat one were dead, which they had to be, didn't they, if they were down here, how come they weren't all zombied out like the other dead people? The small train stopped once, so the guards could fill their canteens in a stream, and Emma approached the fat one, the one who had the reckoning jammed into the top of his pants. "Hey," she said, "what's your name?" Her thinking was that she would act nice, like she wasn't angry at being made a prisoner, and somehow convince him to return the book. At least then she would have it when she escaped. But on being asked his name, the man simply stared at her, his expression empty, and Emma had the sudden realization that he no more knew his name than did anyone else in the world of the dead, that the two guards might talk and act like living people, but scratch the surface, and it was just that, an act. As she and the others were pulled onward, Emma's mind continued to spin. If the guards were the same as the rest of the dead, then who or what was controlling them? Was it the Dire Magnus? Neither guard had mentioned him. They also hadn't given any sign that they knew who Emma was. She told herself that as long as she could keep it that way, she had a chance. Time passed. They trudged on. Then, at one point, Emma looked up and gasped. Their group had come over the ridge she'd seen when she'd climbed the cliff with the Caryadin, and they were heading down to a wide plain that stretched away to more mountains or hills in the distance. There was not a tree or blade of grass in sight. A stinking grey-green river, thick with sludge, slithered across the plain. Trash littered the landscape. But what drew Emma's attention, and what caused her to gasp, was a vast shantytown directly ahead of them that was clustered around an enormous circular structure, from the centre of which a tower of black smoke, the tower of smoke she had seen from the cliff, rose into the sky. Emma had no doubt that was their destination. Soon enough, Emma and the other prisoners were being pulled along the dark, mud-slick passages that twisted between the shacks. The shacks were made from sticks and dried mud, and Emma could see through gaps in the walls to the people moving about inside. As their captors dragged them deeper into the maze, the sky was blotted out by overhanging roofs, and Emma kept close to the back of the woman before her, certain that if she fell, she would be dragged by her wrists through the filth. Several times Emma saw what she took to be scrawny grey cats, but when she looked closer, she saw they were rats, giant ones, with long, curving claws and needle-like fangs, and the creatures hissed and spat whenever a person came too near. Then Emma and the others were yanked to a halt. The sky was still blocked by the ramshackle roofs of the shantytown, but they had come to a sort of indoor arcade or forum. Grim-faced men were moving about, leading bound-together groups of men and women. Half a dozen or so wooden tables had been placed in a line, and at each table sat a man with a notepad and pencil. Emma's tall captor, the one who'd struck her and stolen Michael's knife, moved off without a word, while the one with the hairy stomach... Emma could see the top of the reckoning sticking from the waistband of his pants. She would need to give it a good scrubbing when she got it back. Led her and the others to a table where a bald man sat squinting at his notepad and writing.
"You're late," the man said. "How many is that?"
"Five."
"Your quota's 10.
"Do try finding that many. Lands are empty. Miles and miles, there ain't a soul. We're gonna run out of the dead soon."
"Ha! He'll just make more then, won't he?"
The bald man looked up, and Emma felt his eyes go over her with no feeling before returning to his notepad. She'd worried that someone more in charge would identify her, but apparently she was safe. And as she was thinking this, she glanced over and saw a red-robed figure approaching. It was the same rat-faced man from the beach the day before, and she quickly dropped her head and turned away. As she did, the name that had eluded her, the name Rourke had used for the wizards who served the Dire Magnus, came to her. The Necromati.
"Hurry up," snapped the rat-faced man. "The master is impatient."
"Yes, sir,"
the bald man replied.
"Going fast as we can."
Emma didn't look up till the red-robed figure had moved off.
"Place is busy,"
her fat captor said.
"Been working non-stop for days, and all the ones we're still holding are to go tonight. Something big is happening up above." "What's that, then?"
The bald man aimed his pencil at the top of the reckoning protruding from the other's pants.
"Just a book. Took it from the girl."
"Give it here."
"It's mine, though."
"Not anymore. Not unless you want me to put down you didn't make quota."
Emma's captor grumbled, but pulled the book from his pants. Emma acted without thinking, the brush with the Necromati having made her panicked and desperate, and reached for the book as the man held it out. For one brief moment, she and the man were both holding it. Even if she'd managed to wrench it away, she had no plan for what to do next, and, in any case, it didn't matter. The moment her hand touched the book, she felt the magic stir. And the rest of the world fell away. In her mind, Emma saw an image of an old woman with thick grey hair, sun-spotted skin, and watery blue eyes. Her name was Nanny Marge, and she held Emma's hand in her large, soft one. Only it was not Emma's hand being held, it was the fat guard's hand. His hand when he'd been a child, and Emma experienced a sudden, overpowering love for the old woman. It filled her up.
Off!
Emma was shoved hard in the shoulder, lost her grip on the book, and tumbled to the ground. The bald man was standing at the table, red-faced with anger. He seized the book from the dazed guard and jammed it in the pocket of his coat.
Lock him up, now, and watch that one!
He pointed at Emma. The guard, with a shock, Emma realized that she now knew his name. It was Harold Barnes, though that was all she knew. That, and his love for the old woman, came out of his stupor and pulled Emma to her feet. Emma tried to catch his eye, but the man wouldn't look at her. Dragging on the cord that bound Emma and the others, he led them past the man at the desk and into a dark passageway. Emma stumbled along, trying to make sense of what had just happened. Ever since passing out in Willie's room back in the land of the giants, she'd known that some of the Reckoning's magic was within her, but this was new. And why had the book shown her that old woman? What did it mean? Then they came out of the tunnel, and every other thought was driven from her mind. Traveling through the maze of the shantytown, Emma had lost all sense of direction and progress, and so it was a shock to find herself in the middle of the enormous circular structure she'd seen from across the plain. The thing had an arena-like quality, with its large open central space, but this was not a place for spectators, at least not willing ones. For the circular building, now that Emma was close to it, revealed itself to be made of hundreds of wooden cages, each the size of a boxcar, and stacked on top of one another. And in the cages, Emma could see people. It was a prison for the dead. And that wasn't all, for in the center of the open area, not far from where Emma and the others had emerged from the tunnel, there was a pit, perhaps 50 feet across and 20 feet deep. There was no fire that Emma could see, but black smoke rose up from the pit as if the bottom was covered in smoldering ash. Why were the dead being held captive? What happened here? What did the Dire Magnus's minions do to them? The bald man who'd taken the book had said they were all to go tonight, but go where? She remembered Dr. Pym saying that there was some evil in this land, and she felt as if she'd penetrated to the heart of that evil, only to find that she understood even less than before. And did she want to understand? Emma had never been anywhere that felt so utterly hopeless and foul. She wanted just to get the Reckoning and escape. A lattice of scaffolding connected the cages, and with shouts, kicks, and shoves, Harold Barnes drove Emma and the others up a ladder to a cage on the second level. There was a crude metal lock he had to work at for several moments. Then there was a clank, and he jerked open the door, cut the cords that bound their wrists, and pushed them inside. Emma landed hard on her knees and heard the door slam shut.
Wait! Emma turned and threw herself against the door. You saw her, Nanny Marge! You saw her!
The man stopped on the ladder and looked back, and for one instant his face changed. Quite simply, it came alive, and Emma saw the change and knew for certain then that he'd seen what she had, and what was more, he still remembered. There was a shout, someone from below, calling the man.
No! Emma cried. Don't!
But Harold Barnes had already hurriedly climbed back down. Emma stood there, gripping the bars.
Okay, she thought. Think for a second. When she and Harold Barnes had touched the book at the same time, the magic had opened a window into his life. Then, somehow, either she or the book had given him back his memory. He knew who he was.
Great. And that helped her how, exactly. She was still a prisoner. She still didn't have the book. She still didn't know how to get back to the world of the living. one thing at a time. She just needed a plan. Emma knew that planning wasn't really her strength, but Michael was always coming up with plans. How hard could it be? Night was beginning to settle in, but Emma could see that there were maybe 20 people in the cage, including the 4 she'd arrived with. They were men and women, both young and old, though she, it seemed, was the youngest. Most of the other prisoners were sitting on the floor with their backs against the wooden bars. All of them had the vacant expressions of the dead. As to the cage itself, the floor and ceiling were solid, but Emma could see through the bars into the open arena and smoking pit in one direction and in the other, out over the roofs of the shanty town to the plain and mountains in the distance. She could also see into the cages on either side. One was filled with people, while the other appeared to be empty, save for a pile of dirty rags in a corner. Emma walked to that wall and sat down with her back against the bars. How she wished she had someone to help her, or just to talk to. Kate, Michael, Gabriel, even Dr. Pym. He should be here helping her instead of running a water taxi for dead people, and it was pointless trying to engage the dead trapped with her. As it was, just being around them depressed her. If only Gabriel were here. Her mind kept coming back to that one thought. She knew that only the Keeper of the Reckoning could pass into the world of the dead, but such was her faith in him and in his love for her that some small part of her still clung to the hope that he might somehow find a way. "Stop it," she told herself. "It's just you, and you need a plan." Then a voice behind her, from the cage she'd thought was empty, spoke.
"I wondered how long it would take them to find you."
Emma leapt up and whirled about, staring into the shadows of the other cage. The pile of rags was starting to move, and she watched as the thing dragged itself into the light, revealing twisted and mangled bones, sagging mottled skin, black nails, and, finally, a pair of blinking, bloodshot, violet eyes.
"But where's the book?" the Countess sneered. "You found it, didn't you? When I first came here, the first time I died, I tried to force the Caryadin to give it back to me, but they refused. Only the Keeper, only the Keeper. So where is it, child?"
Emma was gripping the bars of the cage. She felt as if she might pass.